everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Art and Labor. We're the podcast for art workers.
Mm-hmm.
Art workers of the world unite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm OK Fox.
And I'm Lucia Love.
And we're joined in the studio today with Alicia Graziano. I did it Italian style.
Yeah. Hey, y'all.
Lily Bartel.
Hello.
And Dana Capel.
Hi.
They are all new members of the local 2110 Museum, New Museum Union.
Woo-hoo!
Yes.
Ow, 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 ow.
Clapping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are.
they literally just won their union vote on Thursday. Two days ago.
It's very new.
Still flying pretty high.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I still don't feel like it's real. I'm still waiting for it to sink in.
Dana, I know you're definitely on the organizing committee. Are you both on the organizing committee as well?
We are.
Cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a little about what you each do at the museum, I guess. Dana, if you want to go first.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the senior editor and publications coordinator. Which just means that I edit a lot of materials that the museum puts out, catalogs and exhibition materials and other stuff. And I've been there for almost 2.5 years by new museum standards.
And I'm also an editor, but just editor.
That's an interesting distinction because I know they tried to declare Dana as a supervisor, right?
Yeah, so that's actually still in process. I voted under challenge in the election, as did 9 other people. And those ballots haven't been opened because we won by a big enough margin, which is great.
Cool.
But that stuff all has to get decided now that we have a union.
Mm-hmm. And Alicia, what do you do there?
I am a membership and development associate. So I work in the fundraising department, particularly with our members.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I've got my list of questions because I'm always super excited to hear about the emotional realities of going through these processes and I always want to imagine what it would be like if I was in a workplace that could unionize and things that, people found out, anything that you all learned that surprised you through the process, or I guess that's my first question is did anything really surprising happen that you were just oh, how are we gonna get through this one?
Anything surprising happen?
Yeah, I mean, there were twists and turns.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Just the sheer amount of work that we had to do was kind of a surprise. I mean, just because none of us had been through an organizing process mm-hmm. before. We literally put in hundreds of hours of additional work.
Yeah. It was another job on top of our full-time jobs.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, nothing feels too surprising because everything was a surprise because, as Lily said, we were totally new to this. So we're just sort of figuring out everything as we go.
So were you inspired by the recent actions that the MoMA 2110 did?
I think...
What was your decision to reach out to 2110 in particular?
I think because of their history with MoMA, and actually, okay, you played a big role in this.
Oh, stop. I was not fucking fishing for that.
It's true. No, it's true, though.
Did you used to work at MoMA?
No. Me and Lucia went to that, their action that they did.
I was friends with... Athena from mm-hmm. this reading group, and then she reached out to me and was like, oh my god, you've got to come because we're doing this crazy action and we need as many people as we can get. And I was like, oh, I'm there. And then I was texting okay, and I was just like, we got to get there, we got a pod, bring the recorder, we're doing this. And then we just sort of
it's our fourth episode or something.
Yeah. Wow, and cool. You were just like, wait, what's happening at the MoMA? And I'm like, crazy shit, dude, we got to get there now. And you were like, oh, okay, hold on, I gotta just go to this opening. And I was like, no.
And then I was like, wait, oh, I see, because I saw the whole press release and the invite, and I was like, oh, I get it now. It's like it's a labor strike, basically. Not a strike, but a protest at in front of their annual gala. Yeah. It's such a good idea for them to...
Athena just introduced us to everyone at UAW who was organizing that strike, and people were so open to us and just, like, stayed in touch. And then I guess everyone was like...
Everyone, we're all, like, Twitter and Instagram friends now, basically.
Yeah.
Like, just sharing whatever things were going on with them. Because then a little after they... So the moment 2110, for those who don't remember this or, you know, are new listeners, they did a picket line outside of the MoMA's annual gala fundraiser thing. All the big celebs were there. We yelled at Jeff Koons.
Oh, yeah. I was like, hey, I'll work for you. Take this menu. Buy the crudité.
Oh, yeah. Me and Lucia had a thing where we were pretending that the flyers were the menu for the evening.
Amazing.
Then a couple of months after that, the MoMA workers did have like a small work stoppage, like 20 mm-hmm. minutes. Then they eventually won their what they were bargaining for, which was to not lose their step benefits and to not have their health insurance premium increase.
Yeah.
So they had that really great win, which was awesome. I was just relaying to Dana about them once after.
Yeah, I think we were talking about it because we'd been having conversations at the museum, just like over lunch and then over drinks, just like, you know, what's not working? What do we want to change? How can we go about changing it? And this like started maybe a year ago and sort of like gradually expanded and more people got involved. And at a certain point, we were like, well, we want to know like what our options are. No, none of us really know about unionizing like in any detail. Let's just like try to meet with somebody from the union, a union, and like see what they have to say. And so I reached out to you. Okay. And you put me in touch with Athena, who put me in touch with 2110 and a bunch of MoMA people, and 2110 people came to talk to us, which was amazing. And like immediately after that meeting, we all just like looked at each other and was like, yep, this is what we're going to do.
It's so cool. I love that it was all just because of like these sort of chance things where one day it's like, I think I'm going to go to a reading group. I don't know what I'm doing here. And then you make a friend with someone who's like, I'm just also into art. Oh, and then, oh, yeah, come to this thing.
That's how the podcast started also.
Yeah.
Was the reading group. Like
everyone, reading groups are magic.
Go to them. Go to a Marxist reading group. Socialist feminist reading group, dude. It's like the best, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks that you keep in touch with, seeing what everyone else is working on, everyone coming from different backgrounds and stuff, it's great. Really rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to rehash. I feel like everybody kind of knows that like the new museum responded initially with a, what is it, consulting?
They are not lawyers. They do not have law degrees.
Yeah, a law firm.
Not a law firm.
No. They do have footnotes.
Like, yeah. We do not want to give them a degree that they did not earn. They do not have law degrees.
That's true.
But they were basically, they're like, big companies hire consulting firms for all sorts of ridiculous bullshit all the time. It's just like a nice, easy write-off for them to do, like, we're investing in our business, so therefore we hired this consulting firm to talk to our employees about some fucking bullshit. they do it all the time, but this one in particular was an anti-union, like, how to de-unionize your workplace.
Yeah, it was hardcore. Their website is, like, really just, like, for your union-free workplace, like... Yeah. This like
union free privilege.
Ah, yes.
TM. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a trademark. So yeah. I don't know if we can
They've
even
say
it on
They've got a couple of
here.
Them, yeah. Oops.
Yeah. I really loved the infographic of right to work states versus mm-hmm. forced unionization states.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just forced unionization.
If only New York was a forced unionization state, then we wouldn't have had to do all this goddamn work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's the next step.
Art handlers
forced New York.
Are trying to organize with the International Order of Engineers.
Well, they are.
They are.
With Local 30.
Local 30, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were just trying to bargain to have equal pay.
Equal pay. There were PS1 workers trying to have equal pay to their MoMA counterparts. They brought up a really good point in that episode about how the museums themselves are these big permanent structures, so they can't exactly like up and go anywhere.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking a lot about how like the museums are trying to expand a lot of the times. And do you guys want to talk a little bit about the new museum's plans to expand?
Alicia, take the wheel here.
Well, we're heading into an $85 million capital campaign. And I mean, that's great. We want the new museum to succeed. And, you know, we're all big fans of the new museum. We wouldn't have spent as many hours as we did doing what we think will improve the institution. But, you know, we just want to make sure that as a staff, we have the ability to grow as the institution does as well. People come in making as little as $35,000 a year, and that's not sustainable, and it breeds a lot of turnover. And
they rely on that turnover. In my opinion, like a lot of these institutions rely on just like people who are fresh out of college and then turning it over and getting a new person fresh out of college.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even fresh out of college, like
fresh out of grad school.
Yeah, when I started there, I was fresh out of my master's degree. But the vibe is really like you start, you're there for a year or two, and like in like the director's parlance, and you like move on to bigger and better opportunities, and like real talk, like you burn out because it's like really unsustainable. Like you're not making enough to live on, like you're super overworked, and like people do it because they care about the work, they care about making the shows happen, but you can only do that for so long.
Right. And you also need to have, I think most of us have side hustles. I mean, not only are you working a job where you're exhausted because your hours are crazy, but you also then have to go to your second job because you're just not making enough money to sustain yourself. So
yeah, I mean, when I was hired full-time at Artform, they were paying me $33,000 a year. So if average rent in New York City is $800 a room, or maybe $600 a room if you're lucky, or something like that, do the math for, plus they're taking a percentage out for taxes. Plus you have this new health insurance, which it's great to have health insurance at all in this fucking country, but you're paying a bunch out of pocket. Mm-hmm. There's copays, there's the deductible, there's all this shit.
Yeah, and we still pay. I mean, we pay for our health insurance.
Yeah.
Even through the museum. Like, I know MoMA for, like, if you're, like, a single person, like, the base rate health insurance, you don't pay anything, but that is not the case at the new museum. So, but, yeah, like, one thing that was really wild is in, like, one of these meetings that they held trying to convince us not to form a union, part of the presentation was like, oh, you know, like per our research, like a living wage in New York City is like $51,000 a year. And the average salary among staff members is $52,000 a year. And it's like, how do you look at people that you're paying
right.
over $10,000 less than that, less than a living wage, and tell them this? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, they literally said that to me. I make $43,000 a year. So I was like, yeah, case in point. That's why we're forming a fucking union, bitch.
That's like wild that they're like, here's our ace card.
Yeah. You see how good it is? Like an average, just like, I don't know. I haven't done math in like a decade, but I still know an average is not the right figure here.
It sounds to me like maybe the top is making a substantial amount more than they should be.
Not to mention when I first applied for my job, like I asked for $50,000 because that's what a living wage is, you know, and they flat out denied me that. They were prepared to offer me $39,000 when I started at the museum.
The range
in
was
August.
Actually 37 to 40, and which I was only told to suggest 40 if I did not think you were going to negotiate. I don't know if I can say this on air, but I just did.
We can always edit it out.
I also like I was reminded about this by my parents, but there is a difference between average and median.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I will say that in the New York Times, when the museum commented on that statistic, they did use the word median. So
they switch virtual. That's literally just the middle number,
right? Exactly.
They switch from average to median. What they need is mean.
Because mean is average.
Mean will actually like account for how low many of the salaries are.
Right.
But
I mean, either way, if you have, if the average is 52 and you know that the living wage is 51, that means that there's a hell of a lot of people who are making less than 52, which
like
we
half
all know.
Of the people right. in the bargaining unit.
Because also, I mean, we've said this to a lot of people at this point, but when we first started having these conversations, we did a salary share, which was really enlightening for a lot of us because, I mean, I don't know, I knew I was badly paid. A lot of us knew that, but I think we also kind of thought like, maybe it's just me or maybe it's just my department. And then it was like, oh, wait, no.
It's everyone.
This is everyone. No,
literally everyone should do salary shares.
Tell it's your like, friends how much money you make. It will only help them.
Yeah.
Seriously.
It's like a really important political tool. And we got a union out of it. So it works.
Yeah. With a great drop. I love that.
Seriously. I mean, it's just like so taboo and it's so weird.
There's no reason it should be that taboo. It's interesting, I think. Millennials are starting to get on that track of like, go ahead.
I was going to say that's also like one of the things that Marsha Tucker did when she was working at the Whitney. Like she just had this thing where she was like, hey, everybody, like how much are you all making? Because I'm here and I'm like a chief curator. And she was getting way less than.
Yeah, she was making like significantly less than her male counterpart.
Yeah, I feel like that's like a real feminist tool, though. It's
totally.
Oh, wait. In every workplace, how did we come to the understanding that we make, you know, 70 cents on a dollar? Or, you know, how do we understand that these are like fluctuating percentages? And
right. Well, and it's also like, you know, we work for a nonprofit. Their tax returns are public. Like, we know how much the executives are making. Mm-hmm. And it's like 17, 18 times more than like many of us are making. Like, that's a big difference.
And that's not in line with Marsha Tucker's original vision for the museum at all.
Yeah, that everyone would be paid the same amount.
Yeah.
And then everyone would be like switching up their jobs.
Yeah. I think it's awesome that your statement to unionize includes that. I thought the statement, the way it's written is great. And I think it's really catching on with a lot of different types of people who haven't thought about unionization as a feminist issue.
That was really important to us. And like, as this has been happening, I've been editing a volume of her writing that we're publishing with the Getty.
That's so cool.
This summer, fall.
Yeah.
Which is really amazing. And so I've just been like surrounded by her writing and her lectures, especially for like from the 90s, like later on, where she's like really like getting more political and also like questioning a lot of her own previous assumptions about how like inclusivity and diversity should work and like what feminism means and like how institutions should run, like how they should be formed. So yeah, I think this was something that a lot of us were thinking about. Just like how do we use that vision, which was really radical and really special, and sort of like let it show us how we can reshape the museum now.
Yeah. I actually, when we decided we were moving forward with the union, I read Marsha Tucker's book that's already out, The Short Life of Trouble.
Her, like, I guess it's like an autobiography.
Yeah, it's really short, but it's a great read. And when I read it, she mentions so many of her ideas for the new museum, including like paying everyone the same thing. But also she talks a lot about how at the Whitney, she felt like a lot of times she wanted to do something, then she'd be responded, like people would be like, oh no, the budget. And she said that she didn't want the new museum to be like that. And so reading that book when we were starting out in this process was really important for me because I was like, okay, this is the right thing. That's what this museum was founded to do. And I'm really proud of everything we've done.
Yeah.
I think just like on the subject of like people not thinking about like unions or like worker issues being like feminist issues, that I think that like I hope that in the future people look at the New Museum union campaign like as a kind of example of how to like diversify or challenge like a kind of mainstream feminist perspective, because so many of the directors at the museum are women, so many of the people in power at the museum are women, and yet there's still so much inequity at that institution. It just really speaks to how inadequate like a mainstream corporate feminist model is for actually like
making good social change.
Creating equity in an institution.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah.
It's how, like, a representational feminist politics is, like, not a feminist politics because it, like, it doesn't account for, like, class difference and it, you know, it doesn't reshape the institution at all. It just puts, like, different people at the top.
Yep.
But no matter who's at the top, if they're making, like, 20 times more than their employees, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's not a feminist institution.
Wow, that's beautiful. I'm so psyched for you guys that in your big win, like, and I'm really psyched that we get, because we've been wanting to talk to you, you know, forever. We've been trying.
We appreciate it.
We're hard.
But you're in every media outlet is picking this up too.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge deal because it's going to open the eyes of so many other cultural institutions in New York City, which is like a much larger part of the economy than a lot of people realize, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope.
Truly. I mean, we just want the dominoes to start falling, like, tomorrow.
Cultural institutions, call us. We are ready and
willing
to assist.
Don't do it on your work phone.
Yeah, we won't name names, but we're waiting for your call.
I will say, I was just at the town hall, the Decolonize This Place town hall about the Whitney Museum. One of their board members is highly complicit in tear gas manufacturing, which is used at the border and used in protests in general, like as a violent tool to, throw at people doing peaceful and important things. And a lot of the conversations there, I think we're underestimating the big tangible wins that labor organizing can bring to the table. I don't know. I just wanted to put that while we were talking about other cultural institutions, put that out there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think like one of the main reasons we decided that unionizing was like the right thing to do is because it's sustainable, like it's both collective and sustainable. And there are these other collective gestures. Like I know that Whitney put out that open letter regarding that board member. And like, I know, you know, other institutions, other workers at other institutions have done similar things. But like having a union like maintains that collective power and it like gives you rights as like a group of workers that you don't have otherwise. And that's really massive because like, otherwise, these things blow over or, like, they get brushed off and, like...
It's also, like, the letters and stuff. There were open letters leading up to your unionization. There was solidarity with artists.
Mm-hmm.
There was solidarity, you know, with
other
groups.
Yeah, totally. No, and we're so grateful for that.
Yeah, but that all of that is held to account by the union.
Yeah.
And it's just something people should keep in mind.
Just wild to me to see the way that different institutions handle their collective activities, too. Like, I keep thinking about the Met Breuer throughout all of this, which is, I don't know, it's like, because everyone is like, oh, no, there's this thing about, you know, how special the identity of the museum is and how important, like, the cultural activity is and how specific it is for each institution. And then I just think of, like, what about the Met Breuer? That building is tossed around like an orphan. It's just like, oh, now it's like they're talking about selling it again or something. And they're just, and it's just like, you know, there will be like a full turnover there. It's just a mess. Like,
and then the Met implemented a everybody's got to pay now. You got to prove that you live in the tri-state area.
And yeah, it's like, where does all of their money go?
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sense what's happening with them. And they like are constantly in debt and then also constantly trying to expand and like.
It's gross and bad. And I don't think there are certain things that shouldn't have a growth model and like should just belong to the public. And there's anytime an institution starts to charge more is bad and more exclusionary to people that the museums purport to care about.
Well, they're just thinking about like the competitive aspects. But what about like, okay, utopian vision, all of the museums work together. Oh, and they're all like sharing material. Whoa. It's like how you go to a library and you ask for a book and they're like, oh, it's at a different library. Hold on, let us call that library. And then you just get them to bring it over.
Yeah, I mean,
they kind of work like that
To an extent. Like, that's how loans work, though obviously, like, it's much more complicated and it's like a massive amount of money to ship artwork.
There's like crazy insurance involved.
Yeah, but what I was going to say to your point, okay, is like, it's really true that, like, museums are just neoliberalizing, and this is, like, the bigger issue, that, like, they're more and more run on a growth model and, like, on a competitive model of, like, we have to do this, we have to, like, have this brand and be, like, this specific, and we have to constantly be expanding in order to be successful. And it's, like, that, I mean, that model is obviously, like, toxic for everyone, but, like, you know, what is it even doing in the art world?
I mean, as early as 1972, right, with the limits to growth, like, study that was published, I think you really, I mean, I don't know how much that really speaks to, like, the neoliberal, like, business growth model, because it has more to do with population growth, but I don't know, I think it's extremely relevant, because basically the conclusion was that if we can continue under, like, a capitalist system, like, growth is not sustainable. Like, we cannot continue growing as a society.
From an ecological standpoint.
Yeah, I think it's, but I think that, yeah, that definitely applies to this.
That actually reminds me of another book. It's called Raw Materials, and it's about, I forget who the author is. I'll find it. The whole thing tracks the history of language about money and transactions and the growth of cities, the growth of populations, the growth of income. And it just sort of is like from the earliest conceptions, we come to like associate like income as a cancer and as like a growth that's totally uncontrollable. And we've just been thinking about like, you know, workers as being a part of like a functioning city that also is out of control. Like, we can't, you know. I don't know. I just think, like, there's something built in from the beginning. We're, like, not able to manage our own lives. It's amazing.
They want us to be reliant on the growth model. I mean, like, they want...
But it's not, like, it's there is no they, though. Right. There, you know, that's the scary realization.
Yeah,
is
it's
that
like the whole thing.
We're born into an order of things. Or
we are also they.
Yeah,
like,
we are
and
they.
Then,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
you start to realize, like, oh, well, wild, there's this psychology behind the concept of profit, which is, like... We're just like a speeding train in some regards.
It's annoying that art institutions are falling into those same trappings, because it's like we have like libraries as a great model of a way things could operate, and we have worker cooperatives, and we have all of these alternative economic models for structuring things, and I just think if more of them. Maybe it would help if more of them could go against the grain and be like, yeah, we're like Marcia Tucker tried to do.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, contemporary art institutions and contemporary art in general, like, part of its like genre or like what it does is like think through alternatives. Mm-hmm. And like, why are we not doing that now with the way like museums function? Like, I mean, and obviously there are a lot of reasons for that. Like,
It's scary, though, to present alternatives, because we're all accustomed to even like a certain gentrification of the left. You know, like the thought patterns that we have are still limited to like models that have been created centuries before today. And sometimes it's like we have these different ways of communicating now. We have like a differently networked system that doesn't necessarily like allow for the past strategies to function, like, especially now, you know, I feel like everyone is accepting more of a police presence, and we've all sort of like understood there are certain things we can't say. Everybody's going to find out about things. Like, you know, a friend of mine went to a party a couple weeks ago, and then there was like a photo that went up on Instagram, and then the cops found out that my friend was at this party and went to their house and like got them to go to jail. And it's just like, that's the world we live in now. So there's like trying to understand how to organize or do things like that, you know, challenge the state, but knowing full well that like we live in this environment now that makes it, we have to go around so many other corners and avenues. And
yeah.
I think part of the problem is also that this whole concept of newness is so much part of this like entrepreneurial ideology that is like, makes it so easy for like formerly radical institutions to like transition into, because, you know, we're looking for alternatives. We're looking for a different model, a better mousetrap, a new category, you know, whatever. That's Shark Tank language. But it's like, you know, it fits so neatly into that. It's such the natural progression of that concept. And I think that, you know, you look back to the 70s and you see like how directly the like commune movement like fed into Silicon Valley. And like, I think that that really speaks to the way that radical institutions have like progressed into the 21st century. And like, we need to stop sort of fetishizing this concept of newness and this concept of innovation or disruption or whatever you want to call it. But I think that the new museum is totally playing into that category in a really problematic way.
Just going to call it museum now.
Yeah. No more new.
I think like also an interesting thing about where the museum is located and our block is we've got the new museum who's about to undertake an $85 million capital campaign. And then we've got the Bowery Mission, like two doors down, and that's super emblematic of a lot of the things that we've just been talking about. I mean, the Bowery has changed immensely. Like, my dad, I come from like a whole, my family is very rooted in New York City. And whenever my dad, when I first told my dad I was going to go work at this contemporary art museum on the Bowery, he was like, "What? On the Bowery?" I was like, "Yeah." So it's just, I mean, I think location-wise, like, the new museum lends itself really well to a lot of these types of discussions.
Right. Well, they, you know, and they participate in it. Like, the Bowery has changed significantly in the 11 years or 12 years since the museum opened that location. That's not a coincidence. Yeah. And, you know, for this expansion that's happening, like, the museum has owned the building next door. Like, we have some galleries open there now, but like, there were people living there. They've been evicted or will be. Like, that's not great. That's like really, you know, against my politics, but.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's kind of, it's this weird cognitive dissonance, like, because then the new museum sponsored that, like, what is that, like, open discussion thing near, oh God, what was it called? It was like in a park nearby the new museum.
Oh, Idea City.
Idea City.
That's like an ongoing project. Oh, yeah.
That's so bizarre. There was one Idea City a few years ago where an artist made a huge installation out of styrofoam. And it was just like, what? Like, get... No.
Why?
This material is killing all of us. Like, stop using this styrofoam.
Oh, did you tell me the story before? Didn't the artist, like, buy new styrofoam for it too?
Yeah. Oh no, I kind of like collect people who use styrofoam. There was also another person Instagram who found me and they were like, "Hey, check out my art." And they sent that they sent like a DM and I was like, "You're killing us all." Like, what? Where did you get
it? It was like a person making art about global warming, but it was made out of styrofoam.
Yeah, and they made like icebergs out of it. No. It was like, this is too much.
No. Well, that's like, that's why awful. You like, and this is like just a pet peeve of mine, but you can't make like major exhibitions about global warming. Like, you cannot do it because
people just need to stop doing anything. The only way we can stop global warming, just stop moving. Seriously.
Don't breathe anymore, people.
Yeah. Turn it off.
Lily's putting on her little tinfoil hat right now. Wait,
listen, everyone, it's okay because China grew a sprout on the moon. Okay, like we're gonna be all right.
Are we gonna be all right? Or there are certain people in this country that are gonna be all right, but I don't know about us. We'll be in this studio.
Honestly, when you start to go down that line of like, oh wait, sustainability in all of our institutions, what does that mean? How do we like also start reforming the things that we show, and like how do we also start reaching out to other communities where there isn't any physical workspace? And like, I don't know.
Like they don't, like there's, because there's so many people. The thing with art, it's on this elitist platform or perceived that way. Like, and so people feel like they can't even come into the museum at all. And like, so I guess that's kind of like curators and like magazines and stuff are kind of getting on that tick now of like, oh, maybe we've structured this whole thing in a way that excludes poor people.
Well, they would argue, because it's always been this, it was something that actually like John Mackey was saying in his speeches about Whole Foods, where he was like, some people think that the company that I've built is like a little bit too cost prohibitive for people. You know, it's like we've got this fancy food and it's all organic, but I would argue that everyone is invited to the party. You know, don't just fall back on your resentments. You can just walk into a Whole Foods. And I was like, yeah.
And what, shoplift?
Yeah. And then get your picture taken and be banned for the rest of your life. Like, yes, definitely.
But at least you are immortalized through the art form of photography.
Oh, that could got be him. A show.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this back to art, Lily.
Yeah.
Also, we have a Whole Foods on the Bowery as well. So bringing it back to the Bowery again.
That was one of the first ones in New York City, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I remember back in the day, like when we were teenagers, they wanted to unionize that Whole Foods.
Whoa.
Yes.
They've been trying to do it forever, but that company was like, it used to be that workers would get shares if they just started out in the Austin branch, which is weird. Like, you don't really see that in any cultural institutions. Just like, hey, we're starting a company. And, you know, of course, most companies grow out of the phase of altruism or whatever. But like, you know, it would be cool if there was a museum that started out and was like, everybody gets like stock in this or shares, or everybody gets some kind of a benefit and you are able to participate, or you have like some representation on the board of trustees or something. Like once like everyone for a month gets to put on their own show at the museum or something. Like, that would be dope.
Yes.
I think having an employee representative on the board is a really crazy idea and really cool. I don't know.
I love it. I think it should be mandatory.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because they get nice food at the board meetings.
We often get the scraps. On board meeting days, I don't eat lunch and I just wait for the scraps to arrive at 4 p.m.
Oh, scraps. Wow. Yummy. Yummy scraps.
Oh, it's got lipstick on it? That's fine.
Yeah, I get the text from Alicia. She's like, snacks are up.
Yeah.
Snacks have landed.
Snacks have landed.
That's early signs of solidarity, is when the employees start to talk amongst themselves about snack locations.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually been... I sound like such a cheese ball whenever I talk about this, but one of the best things about this whole unionization process has been like the friends that
we made along the way.
Like, aww. We're just all like, I don't know, like we were all in our own little bubbles before. That was definitely how I felt when I worked there. I actually just had my 1-year anniversary this week also. Okay. So big week. But yeah, like when I first got there, like people didn't really talk a ton, and now we're all like really in each other's corner, and it's
been really amazing, like just the friendship and the solidarity. And like as Alicia was saying, like departments are really like separate often, and also sometimes just like there's a culture of like pitting them against each other. It's like, oh, like you're fucked over because this person's late, or like this department didn't do this, so now you have to stay late or whatever. And it's like, we've broken through so much of that just like through the process of organizing. And it's like really incredible.
Yeah. I think a lot of that sort of like plays into this idea of like everybody who's an art worker is like got a side hustle, but that's like their passion project or whatever. So like, you know, maybe we're all artists or we're all aspiring curators, but like that kind of pits us all against each other as employees, since like the kind of assumption is that we're all aspiring to the same role, which none of us will ever get. You know, they're obviously going to hire some rich person, you know, from somewhere else.
I'm pretty sure I've rendered myself unhireable in the art
world. I will say that I didn't form this union to make friends, but massive reward, and it has been like truly amazing. Yeah, I mean, it feels like solidarity really is that like magic thing.
Yeah, it's real.
I mean, it's real. It's definitely real. People push against this, trying to like form community in different ways. I think like community manifests itself in these like strange, sometimes toxic ways, but really what people are searching for is solidarity and having each other's backs. And so I think that's a really magical thing to discover.
I think also when we first announced that this was what we wanted to do, there was a lack of understanding about like why a union, like why not just talk to us and tell us what your demands are. But at the end of the day, we didn't do this for ourselves. Like, yeah, there are things that we want improved in our working conditions, but this is so much bigger than all of us. This is about the future of the new museum, but it's also about changing the cultural landscape and reminding people that like you can achieve so much more when you work together toward a common goal. And we really hope that like that's what comes out of this, that people understand that it's not just about like this win that we've had. It's a bigger, broader statement and opportunity.
That's so wonderful, because that's like how anti-union people will like try to sow seeds of shit and just being like, oh, well, you guys are just in this for yourselves and get your own paycheck and blah, 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 blah. And so it's like the more I think people have realized over like the years that that was bullshit.
One really nice thing like one of our co-organizers came up with is just like these little like solidarity like notes and gifts that like for the past couple of weeks, like different people, different organizers would just like go around and like give everyone some candy and a little like note that's like encouraging. And like a bunch of people did that. And it was just like, oh, like we're not alone. Like people are looking out for you. Like it was, it was a really special thing, especially because, you know, like the past few weeks have been exhausting, like physically, emotionally. Like I think they've taken a lot out of all of us.
Yeah.
And so it was just really nice to like know that, like, you know, your like colleagues and your comrades like see that and they're like here for you and they have your back.
It's like even the fucking capitalists should be like understand that like having like better treatment and better wages is better for the fucking business. Like,
yeah, like turnover is not cheap.
No,
right?
Yeah,
God, totally. Like that's what's wild.
Yeah, I mean, especially going into an expansion, like you want a team who's been there and who knows their jobs. You don't want a bunch of people who are like, oh, okay, I've been here a week and I guess now we have a new building and now I have to figure out my job. And
like no one's here to tell me about
it.
Yeah, so it's like you lose a lot of like institutional memory when turnover is so high, and that has real consequences.
Yeah, and not just mental health, physical health too, like with construction. I know, I think you mentioned that, Dana, or one of you mentioned it in one of the articles.
In Jacobin.
In Jacobin.
Lily and Jacobin.
That'd be me.
Yeah. It's a really good point. Like, a lot of the times, to cut costs, like, safety is not treated the way it should during construction. So having a union to protect you in legally in these situations is helpful, I think.
There are times when, like, the water shuts down on, like, our half of the Bowery for, like, almost an entire day. And like in my and Lily's department, like we are allowed to work from home when that happens, but that's not the case throughout the museum. Like people have to go in and then like walk like 10 minutes in the cold to the Whole Foods bathroom. Like it's wild. Like not,
nobody,
it's not
should
okay
be forced to work like that. Like it's just not cool.
Is that
like,
also weird for visitors too? Like,
yeah, visitors yeah don't even get the bathroom.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's the city's problem.
It's the city's problem.
It's, you know,
like it's because of all the construction on the Bowery right now.
Yeah, it just goes back to the whole gentrification issue of the Bowery. Like, I mean, there are two or three new hotels that either have just opened or are opening really soon on the Bowery.
Ugh, those new hotels are ridiculous.
Yeah, it's
but
like,
their names are so good. I love being sandwiched between public and citizen.
Oh my God.
And I have to say, their bathrooms are also good, which I know from when they turn the water
off. Yeah. I love the design elements of the hotel rooms when they keep those little, like, weird wire mesh cages that, like, it used to be that, you know, how people used to live on the Bowery. Like, you just get a little wire cage to sleep in. And they just, like, kept elements of those.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
in there the were hotels?
There were, they were, like,
No, but, like, now they
no,
they
not, kept, yeah, now they kept, like, elements of them.
I don't know why I'm surprised.
The hotel rooms to be like, wow. So
historic
grudgy
Bowery.
Yeah. People don't understand the people's living conditions. Like, when I was trying to talk to my coworkers about what my life is like, I'm like, oh, the only reason I'm able to live in this city is because I share a room in a 3-bedroom. And I know a lot of people who share a room in a 3-bedroom. And, like, there's so many of us out there. And it's totally something that, you know, the people don't understand how much of a problem that is on plumbing, on like all these infrastructure. Like,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. I share a room in a studio with Charlie, who I love. Oh. But we also share a bathroom with like three of our neighbors.
Ooh. Yeah. Wow.
It's like one of the remaining like boarding house style brownstones.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was wild.
Yeah. Love does not fix the plumbing.
No. It's tried, but it's up.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was going to recommend to people, if they want to listen to our first couple of episodes, where we followed this book called
Art
Gangs, and it's by Alan W. Moore, and he was one of the ABC No Rio guys.
Oh, cool.
And he talks about the history of Soho and Chelsea and the Village, and even in Harlem, a lot of Harlem in there too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recommend that for people are interested in art and gentrification history in New York City.
And punk stuff.
Punk stuff.
Spent like the vast majority of my youth at the Saturday hardcore matinees in ABC No Rio.
Oh,
so
well, that's what I was gonna bring this up. That's what I forgot to say. Yeah. You posted your anarchy tattoo.
Oh,
on
yeah.
Oh
my God, amazing.
Yeah, I know. That was like something that came up in the Jacobin interview, but they luckily didn't print, was like that I was
print
an
it
anarchist.
Now.
Yeah. I've since been reformed. I'm now a socialist. So
hey, why not both?
No, <I'm> out.
I'm fine with people being anarcho communists and the like. I'm the whole spectrum. I'm into it.
Yeah. We gotta stop, you know, mincing all of these terms. It's just too much. Like when you get little hyphens and you just like jamming all these left words together. It's like, I don't know.
I was just saying you shouldn't be embarrassed of your anarchist tattoo. It's still good.
We love it.
It's still here. Yeah, but I think that's actually what's interesting about these like more mainstream progressive like groups like the DSA that are sort of like entering the public sphere. They're like kind of giving people at least like from an electoral politics perspective, like a just kind of more generally like progressive platform, like of the DSA endorses so-and-so candidate, you know, like some anarchist and some socialist are both probably going to vote for them. So I think that that's interesting and like bringing, you know, progressive politics into the mainstream a little bit more.
Well, if you're an anarchist who votes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of divided on that issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was like a member of the Working Families Party. So I was a non-voter. I like changed so I could vote for Cynthia Nixon in that gubernatorial primary. But yeah, I was a non-voter for a really long time.
I always vote working families line. But, you know, I've got mixed feelings about voting, but I did work as a poll worker this year because I have no
job.
I
did too.
You did too? Yeah. Oh my God. It's actually kind of rewarding to, because you are just there with your neighbors all hanging out all day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I like really wanted to do it. I definitely, you know, those Subway ads that were like, be a poll worker. I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to get involved in, like, I'm just going to do more for the community.
But it's a nightmare. It's like 12 hours of work also.
Yeah, you have to get there at like 5:30 in the morning, and you're there until at least like 9:30.
At least.
And there were people who were telling me about the 2016 presidential election. They were like, oh, yeah, we didn't get out until 2:30. And I was like, I was like in my bed in fetal position at that time, the night of the 2016 election. So like, glad I was not at the polls.
Thank you for your service.
How did you guys get into like more left-leaning politics? I'm just curious.
I guess I'll just talk about how I got involved in like being a big union fan, if that helps. I come from, my parents are teachers, so unions are like really, really important to my family. My dad was tier one in the teachers union, which is like a unicorn thing at this point. So like, you know, the idea of having, you know, a pension and like having long-term health insurance, all of these things are like, they're just a given to my parents who have been in these unions. And then I got my first job and I was like, oh, okay, like, my pay sucks, and, like, you know, there are just a lot of things that I feel like my whole life I was told I would get once I, like, if I followed a path, and then I was like, wait, no, like, my parents had all this great stuff because they were union members, and I was like, unions are cool. And somehow the opportunity to form a union came up in this, like, really magical, beautiful way, and I'm excited to be a union member myself now.
Yes.
Yay.
I'm clapping again.
Yay.
Yeah. I think that's so cool.
Different from your question, but
it's totally in line with what I was asking. Yeah. And yeah, just big victory lap. So psyched to have you guys here on this victory lap. I don't know if either of you have any you know, parting words or like suggestions or like your personal journey to more lefty politics. I know Dana didn't really speak about this much.
I was radicalized by Twitter.
Oh, sick. Sick. It works. Posting works.
No, whoa. I'm like kind of kidding. I had, you know, I grew up like middle class and suburban, so I was just like, the past 10 years have been a lot of like unlearning some like mediocre to bad shit that are just assumptions that you grow up with when you grow up like that. And speaking of, I know that supervisors have been reading my Twitter and Lily's Twitter and also my partner's Twitter. Please stop. We have a union now. It makes me uncomfortable. I realize it's public. Please stop.
Oh, my God. That's so frustrating.
It's like a lot.
Just block them.
I have, but like, I have a public Twitter. So it's like
private.
Yeah. We're staying strong. Staying public. I'm reading Charlie's Twitter.
That's so wild.
It's like... Yeah. Inappropriate. Anyway.
That's totally inappropriate.
Like, what are y'all trying to find out?
Union secrets.
Right. Those are going to be the most public.
Yeah, definitely going to post all those public for you guys.
Oh, yeah.
Just got out of a dope organizing meeting.
Like, here's what we did.
Watch out.
1 out of 37.
If any higher-ups at the new museum are listening, give Art and Labor a grant.
Yes, do it.
Yeah, join the pay our rent tier and we'll put your name on the board of trustees.
Yeah, you can join our board of trustees.
We don't have anybody yet except for us, I guess.
Pay us off, just try. Just see if it works. You might as well try. It's so funny, in that Art Kings book there's a story about a person who was protesting the MoMA, but then the MoMA hired her to be their photographer.
Mm. Yeah, oh, yeah. That's one way to quiet people down.
Just a thought. Yeah. Food for thought.
Come on, give me a show.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. Like, I feel like I know a lot of people who, like, I went to undergrad with who, like, will post on Facebook, like, every day, like, I can't fucking get a job. Like, I majored in art history, and, like, I'm applying to jobs at museums, like, every day in cities like Seattle and, like, Chicago and places like that. Mm-hmm. And they just, like, can't get work. And I'm sitting here, like, you know, I work at a museum. Like, I'm obviously, like, in a privileged position, like, relative. But at the same time, I'm just, like, stop trying to work in this industry. Like, it's so fucked. Like, just go, like, work in a bakery because, like, you'll be better off, you know? Like, better benefits. Get to work early. Get to leave early.
That's what everybody said when I was going to SVA. Like, the whole faculty was like, if you think you can do anything else, anything, just do that instead. And people got scared. They were like, oh, no. Like, yeah, maybe you're right. And they would go, they're like, okay, I'm going to try social work, or, like, I'm going to go and, you know, like, just go study something else, or, like, drop out, or, like, just stop showing up to classes because it was this weird haze that you have to go through.
Yo, when I was getting fired at my job, I was like, I'm going to work at the post office. I was like, I basically do mailing. I'm going to try to be a warehouse worker or something like that.
So, like, Gerhard Richter actually tried working as a dental worker. For a while,
undercover boss style.
No, he was like, I'm gonna quit art. I'm gonna work it in a dentist office for a long. Yeah, happens to everybody.
Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns were window installers. Seems all right.
Oh yeah.
Randomly, I work at a vintage store now. I don't think I'll ever be hireable in the art world again. That's fine with me, though, because honestly, Medicaid is way better insurance than any of this bullshit. It sucks. They all suck.
When I was on Medicaid, I went to a really nice dermatologist in the financial district. I had a rash, but I was like, wow.
It's good, you know, and folks, I'm going to reiterate this, but we reiterate this a lot, but if you try to organize and you get fired or pushed out, get on that unemployment. Get on that unemployment insurance. Apply.
Yeah. Also, it's illegal if you're organizing.
Exactly.
They can't fire you.
Even if you quit.
Exactly.
Try to get on unemployment because nobody really pays attention.
And it's the line is tricky because they try to push you to quit. And so you're basically being fired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can say that.
But also, especially if you're working for a small nonprofit, get the pay stubs, get everything that you need, be prepared because they'll fuck you in the end. You'll be fucked by the nonprofit sector. It's disgusting.
But also,
agreed.
If you work in the nonprofit sector, think about unionizing.
Yeah, yeah. Again, talk to us.
Hell
we
yes.
are ready.
Yeah. We have our phones right here.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's the great thing about the union is that, like, so many of the people that we've worked through, I mean, literally every single person that we've worked with at the Union 2110 has been a museum worker or some kind of, like, cultural worker who went through the unionization process, became radicalized, became really excited about unions, and then has just decided that that's what they want to put their energy towards. And, you know, like, I can't speak for the whole organizing committee, but I can speak for the three of us saying that, like, we're, like, ready to help people with their campaigns. Like, we're ready to show up and, like, do that work because even if we're not getting paid, it's fucking worth it.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, not everything has to be about this, like, transactional
thing. It's not a quid pro quo bullshit. This is different than what people's imaginations can comprehend sometimes, I feel. I want it. Finally, we're at the end of the show, but do you guys have any, like, shows or
personal projects,
social media handles that you'd want to plug on the air right now?
I'm a social media ghost, so
good for you.
just the New Museum Union Twitter and Instagram. Yeah.
Sorry, but I'm going to plug my magazine.
Do it.
Do it.
Everyone should subscribe to the Whole Earth Catalog. That's
I love the Whole Earth Catalog. Like,
WH?
The fake Whole Earth, not the.
Okay,
I've seen it.
My Whole Earth.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's so
funny.
Okay,
that's www.whole.earth, E-A-R-T-H. And it's free to subscribe.
It's so funny. I've seen it. Like, when did you start it?
I started it, like, just about a year ago.
Yeah. I don't know where I saw it. Maybe Charlie or something. So I feel like somebody showed it to me.
Cool. Well, got to plug it. Yeah. It's my passion.
No, not the original Whole Earth that we were talking about before, where the hippies, like, fucking Steve Jobs were really into it and then were bought out. And I love...
Yeah, the original Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Our new neighbors.
Yeah. Not if I can help it.
I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much to you guys. This has been really amazing. Thank you to the rest of the organizing committee, who are just like the most amazing, beautiful, strong people. And I think we all feel really lucky to work with them. Thank you so much to like everyone who supported the union within the museum and outside the museum. Like, we're so grateful.
Yeah. I'd like to just take 1 minute to thank Maida Rosenstein.
Maida!
Yeah.
Maida!
Maida! Maida! Maida!
She's honestly, like, the most inspiring person, I think.
She kicks ass.
Any of us has ever
she's
met.
She's, like, powerful.
She kicks so much ass.
But also Megan Grant and Olga from 2110 have been, like, so amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we're so grateful for them. And our lawyer, Dana Lassia.
Dana. Love her. She's amazing.
Yeah. No, we've been so lucky to, like, have the support and guidance and knowledge of, like, really amazing people.
Yeah, the UAW is a real family. Like, come join us. There's so many perks.
That rules.
Also, there is hella great UAW vintage gear on eBay.
There was, but we have it on.
Oh yeah, we bought like 99%.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah. I also just want to say one thing to like the general public. And it's not anything crazy. It's just that while the union has been established, we have a really long fight in terms of contract negotiation ahead of us. So, like, we're really counting on, like, continued public support and, like, yeah. So the fight's not over. Like,
how can people help you?
I don't know, really.
Well, follow the Twitter and the Instagram.
Yeah,
follow our Twitter. Don't tweet at the New Museum because that just goes to our coworker Mitch. And
we love Mitch.
We love him. He's super cute. And
don't make his job harder.
Bogged down with mentions. So but just keep us in your mind and don't forget about us.
And we'll reach out when we know more and like when there are more concrete ways to support us.
Yeah,
cool.
But
hell yeah. Thank you all for coming on. And we will link to all these things in the show notes as well. So everyone check that there. And that's also where you can find our Drip and our Patreon if you guys want to support us with money. But it's fine also if not.
You guys should get some advertisers. It worked for Whole Earth.
Mm. Oh, my God. We've had people offer and I'm just like, nothing makes sense. Nothing makes sense to advertise on here. I'm sorry. Like, we're just going to badmouth
it. Yeah, especially because we will have episodes where we're like, we need to get rid of advertising.
Yeah.
Advertising should die.
We're just like, it's a bullshit industry that shouldn't exist.
Yeah, like, clearly the people who approach us are, like, not listening to that.
That like, seems, like, good.
Watch Bird Box on Netflix.
No, we want to watch the Velvet Buzzsaw.
Yeah.
We want to do an episode on Velvet Buzzsaw.
I have no idea.
That's the
that
Jake
is.
Gyllenhaal movie where he's an art critic that's coming out.
Oh, my God.
I'm so excited.
Scary. Oh, okay, not for me. I can't handle it.
It takes place in a museum.
And there's blood.
Definitely not going to watch it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, probably not. Also.
I'm watching the Cat Show documentary right now. So.
Oh,
it's really cute.
Well, it's so great to have everyone. Like, it's so fun to talk amongst a group like this that I've met Dana before, but never met either of you. And it's just like such a delight. It's so fun. I had such a good time. And I'm so thankful for you guys for coming on. everyone, support the new museum union and all of their efforts. See you guys soon, and let's have fun.
It doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company. Let's have fun. 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 Let's have fun, lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, lots of fun.